poetry helps me give refuge to the imperishable. And I think naming that as good is a choice of wisdom. It's wise of me to say, rather than an acquisition of wealth, I wish to really see myself honestly. And I wish to invest in that seeing and to share that seeing. Rather than an acquisition of honor, I wish to gain understanding. Rather than an acquisition of social power, I wish to know the one whose life is being spoken all around me, in the soil and the stones and in the words of, and faces of other people. Poetry helps with that. And yes, that is wisdom.
Paul J. Pastor is a poet, writer, editor, and a former guest on this podcast. He's the executive editor for Nelson Books, an imprint of HarperCollins, where he publishes work that encourages spiritual renewal. In our last conversation, recorded 4 years ago, we discussed his poetry collection, Bower Lodge. We speak today about his recent collection, The Locust Years, and about Christian poetry generally. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. So Paul, it's been a few years since we had our last conversation. It was one of my favorite conversations, and it's great to be back on the podcast today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So we'll be talking about your latest poetry collection, The Locust Years, which was published last year with Wiseblood Books. But I also want to talk to you about poetry more broadly, and especially about religious poetry and Christian poetry specifically. And I thought we might begin there as kind of a lead into your own work. You wrote the preface to a 2021 small anthology of Christian verse, and that it's a small anthology titled An Outcast Age. And I wanted to ask you about something you say there. You write this, quote, I'm quoting you here, one of the tiredest old tropes in the tired old trope book. and then you add, a work I hear is published exclusively in hell. Is this, you say that Christian art is bad art. Okay, now you go on to qualify that statement. You acknowledge that there is bad Christian art, the art that is kitschy or low quality, but you add that such products are neither real Christianity nor true art. Now, I fully get the point about such work not being true art. I'm interested, though, in the line about it, how low art is not necessarily real Christianity. Does low artistic quality prevent something from rising to the status of real Christianity? It's a provocative statement. I'm not pushing back against it. I'm just kind of asking to kind of tease it out.
Well, it's a theological question that's probably a bit above my pay grade, so I'll just own that. Maybe I can best say it by reframing it positively. The Christian faith has such remarkable spiritual resources for the artist that where there's dishonesty or a collapse of craft, and you know, when you say what good art is, that's kind of where a lot of this question hinges. What makes something good? There's two ways for it to be good. One is for it to be good in craft and in form, something that objectively has been well made. But there's also a sense of goodness that has to do with sincerity and with honesty of the spirit, that even if there are deficiencies of form or of craft, there's still something worthy about that. So I'm not trying to, you know, punch down at someone who's trying sincerely to express something. However, often, especially when we're dealing with kitsch, there's a relationship of a cliched expression or a thin expression with actually a bit of a dishonesty of experience or of soul. And when you're encountering something that's not well made, sometimes you're also encountering something that's not well felt. And to equate that with our faith is something that I don't wish to seed that ground. I wish to say, hey, you know, we all have something to contribute, even if we're not all going to be, you know, perhaps world-class artists, or if our craft still has to grow, that's fine. But at least let it come from a place of honesty and of strength and of inner life. And if it does not have that honesty or that strength or that inner life, I do think it's worthy to ask, well, is this actually coming from a place of Christianity, or is that a label that we've stuck on this because of a particular doctrinal belief? But actually the core of it isn't really strong enough to support that at all.
I think I like that response a lot. I love the point you're making about honesty, and it raises the question for me about whether you can have honesty amid cliches. In a way, this brings back the episode in the Bible, the book of Isaiah, when Isaiah gets his prophetic call, right? He's in the temple and he sees the Lord, you know, above him, and he says, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, I am undone, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell amid a people of unclean lips. And the unclean lips is interesting how you take that, but at one level you could say, and then remember the seraphim take a coal from the altar and they touch him, and he suddenly he's purified and able to speak. That uncleanness there might mean, you know, profane, meaning not sacred, but that profanity can also be a function of being unable to speak the truth, not having the voice to speak what is true. And it seems like cliche is the place, when we resort to cliche, where we're not yet able to speak what is true.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And honestly, you know, I love the Isaiah passage. My mind also goes to, of all things, Thoreau's essay on economy, which I was just reading last night on the plane. And he was talking a lot about fashion and how people dress. And he's talking about it as an extension of honesty, like somebody who cannot socially, like they can't bring themselves to wear patched clothing. They would rather almost be naked than to go out with a patched piece of clothing, because this says something about them. And he goes on a multiple page tirade against basically fashion that he says is dishonest. He's like, you know, the head monkey in Paris puts a traveler's cap on his head, and all the other monkeys do the same thing, which is basically the imitative thing. And that's what cliche is. That's what a lot of people are doing in bad art. They saw somebody else do something, they felt something, and then they're trying to repeat that rather than pushing through the difficulties of asking, what is my unique gift? Do I have something to say? And how can I say that as clearly and directly and simply and honestly as possible? So, you know, these are complex conversations. There's lots of moving pieces to what makes art good, what makes faith good, how do these relate? But I think they distill down to a state of the spirit that is able to say, you know, in Hopkins' words, what I am is me, for that I came. And when we encounter something that feels direct and honest in that way, even if it's highly crafted, there's a magnetism to it. There's a pull. We want to spend time in the radiance of that object or of that idea. We all have the capacity to participate in that. But we fail all the time, even if we're, you know, well-trained or very good at it, simply because it's hard to be ourselves. It's hard to be honest in that deeper sense. So in that moment of connection where inspiration is happening, we feel connected through the Holy Spirit or wherever that thing comes from, and connected to our audience, to our reader, to our viewer, whatever, there's just that magic sense of really being, the only word is connected, to something larger than yourself. And I think that good art and good faith enables us to practice that and to give gifts in that context. So perhaps I'll just leave it at that, if that makes any sort of
great.
Sense.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Paul. It's an excellent point. And it leads me to the question about whether you find that happening in the field of Christian poetry more generally. I think I've either heard or read a remark you made that Christian poetry has been through a resurgence in recent years, or perhaps the past couple decades even. There are a number of outstanding poets who do not shy away from religious and spiritual subject matter. I'm thinking about voices, you know, like Paul Mariani, Christian Wiman, Marilyn Nelson, Dana Joy, Diane Glancy, Scott Cairns, and others. Poets who have been on the scene for a while, right? And then there are others who are more recent. Laura Rees Hogan, Abigail Carroll, Benjamin Meyer, Sally Reed, many others. I've got two questions for you here. Do you agree that this is something of a golden age for Christian poetry? And if you do, to what do you attribute this renaissance?
I so appreciate that you're asking this. I feel like a bear of, like, you know, is it Pooh Bear who's the bear of very little brain? Like, I really do feel that way. I'm like, I don't know. I think I might be too close to it. But I have said, yes, I think we're living in a small little renaissance. I don't think we get to know if it's a golden age for a couple centuries. So I just don't think we get to make that call. However, I will say there is more good work being written right now than I can possibly read. And that's fantastic. And I sense an incredible hunger for that among readers. One of the things that's been a delight, even of releasing The Locust Years, has been, you know, poetry can have this reputation of it's poets writing for poets. And the only audience of poetry is people who write poetry. That's just not true. It's not true historically, and it's not true when you sort of adjust your visual lens right to view, you know, the market. Like, people actually do have a high capacity to appreciate and understand poetry when it says something that they feel is valuable. They just have very little patience for the fashionable poetry of the latter half of the 20th century. They're just not here for that. And being totally frank, I'm not really here for that either. So the poets who are doing well, to me, seem to be poets who are attentive to form, are not bound by, you know, are not bound by the past. They're not necessarily old-fashioned poets, but they're very attentive to form. They're working often in meter and in rhyme, and they're working with huge ideas, sincerely with huge ideas. It's not a poetry that's focused exclusively on the individual, but they're asking something valuable. They're exploring something valuable. So I love all the names that you said. They feel like a renaissance. I mean, you know, Dana Gioia alone is somebody who has made a profound contribution to American letters. And many of the names on that list, myself included, really are in some ways amateurs. I mean, we're publishing widely, we're working hard, but all poets to some degree are poets who are writing out of love and you know, in that old sense of amat, like I love, we're amateurs. And so, I think there are some very exciting things happening right now. You see it institutionally with some great MFA programs, great journals, like all of that. But I also see it in ordinary people spending $15 or $20 on a collection of poetry when they could go out and buy a couple good burritos with that. And that's kind of revolutionary right now. I just think it's great. And they're spending money on sonnets. And that says, like, oh, something's happening. There's a hunger here. I want to see that grow. And it's a joy and a pleasure to be able to participate in what's happening. And yeah, I don't think it was happening quite the same way 20 years ago. I think that's an objective fact. And part of that is due, frankly, to the internet.
Yeah.
The barrier to entry is really low to encounter something that touches your heart and touches your mind.
Yeah, I agree. I'm you know, I teach a lot of this stuff, and I think it's fantastic. I love it. And I don't, I love it for its craft, but it's not just the craftiness alone for which I love it. You talked about the fashionable poetry of the late 20th century, for example, latter half of the 20th century, which I myself, being a professor of English, I get it. I understand it. I can appreciate things about it, but I don't love it. I remember talking with a guest about a year ago who was commenting on how a poet he knew and loved, his wife actually, I was talking with Andrew Silver about his wife, Anya Krugovoy-Silver, a very fine poet, excellent poet, and how she had lost patience with a certain kind of vacuous postmodern poetry. I to me that really resonated. I thought, yeah, this is what I don't find in the kind of poetry we're talking about is vacuousness. There's a lot of substance there, which I love.
I love it too.
Yeah. Okay, let me go on to your latest collection here, Locust Years. So you remember I was a huge fan of your last collection, Bower Lodge. And I love this new one too, The Locust Years. And I hear you've got a third one under contract. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually have two under contract.
Two.
So I have so The Crystal Hand will be coming out in December, and it's sort of a spiritual companion to The Locust Years. Very excited about that. I think it's my best short work to date, although The Locust Years I also really love. Then I'm also working on a large work in progress called The Fire Cantos, and have been since, about 2018 in one form or another. And this is the one that sort of daunts me, being totally honest. You know, A.E. Stallings, Alicia Stallings, who's the present Oxford professor of poetry, has been kind enough to pop in and do some reading. And so I'm just like kind of up to my ears, just thinking through how do you tell a really sort of long narrative poem. And, you know, it's themed around the concept of fire, the spiritual concept of fire, specifically like as seen in Wildfire in the West. And it's a little daunting. It's just huge. So to answer your question, yes, I have two works under contract, both with Wise Blood Books, both to be illustrated by Michael Cook, the brilliant neo-romantic artist who did The Locust Years. And yeah, that partnership in itself is just so satisfying and delightful. I love working with artists to bring a visual element to my work.
I love that. And your wife's also an artist, right, Emily?
Yes, Emily is a classically trained painter.
I've seen some of her stuff online. It's beautiful. I love the visual, the art, and the Locust Years also. So last time you were on, you talked about how you love short poems, but you also have this real passion for sort of longer narrative poetry. So here you go, right? You got all right. Well, that's great to hear. Now, last time you were on, you remarked provocatively that you're a poet and that. Therefore, as you put it, therefore, it's your job to tell the truth. Okay. Yeah. Now, so I'm thinking about these poetry collections, right? So the two that are out and you have the two forthcoming, are they telling, I'm going to assume that they are going to, as you do typically, you're telling the truth, but are they the same truth or are they different truths, or is your sense of what is true changing as your poetry evolves?
It's a really good question. I had a college English professor who theorized that every writer, no matter how big their output, only writes about one thing, but that that writer doesn't actually get to know what that thing is. Like only other people can tell them what it is. And they're often wrong. So I'm the wrong person to ask about that. However, I'll speculate a little bit. You know, Bower Lodge was a work of decomposition. It was a work about what happens in a life when, in a wonderful way, you fall apart and become something different. The Locust Years is a book that is about the recovery of hope and faith, like in a really deep sense. The Crystal Hand will be a book about being held, about a loving presence that is unseen beneath your feet and yet is containing all the love and all the loss and how that is experienced in a life. So are those three things telling the same truth? Yes, I think they are. That truth is life wants to live. Like there's this irrepressible thing amid grief, amid loss, amid difficulty, amid confusion, amid success, amid failure. There is something that wants to live and to express itself and to be beloved and to be present. And sometimes that falls apart, and sometimes that grieves and loses hope, and sometimes that rejoices in being held. And so I do think that those are all the same truths, but they're very different expressions or understandings of those same truths. And so, of course, the collections feel different. With that said, I think the poetry in each of them is very compatible. Should there ever be, one day, a collected works of Paul, I don't think that poems from those collections would feel funny if set next to one another. And in fact, you'd probably see some delightful developments and connections, things that I'm maybe even too close to recognize, but that are present. So
okay.
I think that as my poetry grows, I continue to explore simply what I'm interested in. I'm following magnetically something that I'm interested in, and that progression is natural.
That's terrific. Okay, so let me ask you then about the preface to The Locust Years. And by the way, I can fully see your poetry being collected. Certainly it'll be anthologized, and I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out. But you write a preface to The Locust Years, and you title it cleverly Letter from Paul. So it's a kind of a new Pauline epistle, right?
It's got epistle,
Yeah, right. And in it, you mention writing the poems in this collection during the years of the pandemic. Which you acknowledge were obviously a difficult time for many, many people, right? And you write in the collection that real hope is painful. And you mentioned this the collection's about kind of recovery, you know, of hope. And then you mentioned also that to hope is to risk disappointment, and that if the hope is large enough, it even means to risk despair.
Yeah.
I found that provocative. Do you feel that you risk despair as a poet, or do you consider your poetry a response or remedy to such despair?
Yeah, I feel we risk despair just by living, like by being a person, like that's the risk of despair. So is poetry a response or a remedy? Yeah, it can be. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it exacerbates despair. Totally honestly, it just depends on the poet. What is coming out of your life? Like poetry should be the expression of what's happening inside. It's like, you know, I use images of a cider press often, or of a distillation. It's like poetry is the sweet liquor that comes when you're really squeezed and you're really pressed. It's the good stuff. It's distilled. But it's coming out of the product of a human life, of a human soul, if it's good. So is it a response or a remedy? Well, maybe metaphorically, it's what comes when despair presses you, or when whatever the thing you're wrestling with is pressing you. So the Locust Years really is about the folly of hope, the impossibility of hope. And yet that's completely paradoxical. There's multiple stories from the Christian scriptures where God is doing something amazing and people laugh. Like, the response is laughter, not from mockery, but I think it's a self-protective laugh. I'm afraid to believe that this little girl who just died can be raised to life again, even though Jesus is saying she's just sleeping. So of course I'm going to laugh, because that is so much safer than belief or than hope, when my heart is so involved. And that's the dilemma at the core of the title, The Locust Years. God says, you know, I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten. What? Like, okay, that sounds great, but really? No, I can deal with them being gone, but I can't deal with the hope that you're saying you're going to give me back something that was taken. It's easier for me to just not hope. I choose to reject that and say, I'm not going to laugh at that promise. I'm going to try to believe that promise, but that's hard. That's a risk. And because some things are so close to our heart, they'll either disappoint us or they will place us in despair. But that's the leap. That's the work of faith. That's the invitation. And it strikes me that, you know, Christ doesn't ask us to do anything here that he did not do himself. On Holy Saturday, he laid in the sleep of death and surrendered completely to that, with the belief that his Father would raise him again by the Holy Spirit. But that was an act of faith. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to wax too eloquent on this, but I think that poetry is a response to despair. And whether or not that poetry is able to offer us spiritual resources in the middle of it just largely depends on our ability to be courageous and to fully embrace the difficulty and the joy of being a human.
It's a great response, Paul. It really is. It's a great response. And actually, I was thinking about some version of this recently. My wife and I were having a conversation just yesterday, and we have this occasionally now. I'm in my late 50s, and so I think a lot now about what the years have wrought, you know, locust and other years in my own life, and about the ways that God's promises distill on me. I mean, sometimes the promises are, you know, sort of take the form of some event that was not there until it is. Other times, it's more like the promises reveal a thing that always has been there, but not perceived by me, or not fully ripe able to be, you know, kind of enjoyed, appreciated, plucked, right, for its sugars and its nourishment. And these things distill more gently on the soul. And I was thinking about one of your poems in the book I'd love to talk to about. In fact, maybe we could go back and forth a bit and read and discuss a few poems in here. Is that okay if we go through?
Yeah, let's do it.
So this is, I'm going to start here with the poem Photosynthesis, which is on page 16. And there, again, this is going to be a joke, because there are so many good poems in the collection that gives the wrong impression to read a very small number. But nonetheless, these are at least will give listeners a chance to hear some of these poems, which are just beautiful. So I'll read this short poem, Photosynthesis, and then I have a question to you about it. I'd love to hear you talk about it. Here it is, Photosynthesis. When you have loved beyond your first horizons and have turned to your beloved and begun to wonder who they have become under the verdigris of good long years, and when you learn to know the veritude of glances, of every shared hour, of daily hands that lay vast truths upon the hollows of your back and tremble under dark sheets in the night, you will understand. Each green leaf contains a billion mouths which spin, which open, hungry under sun. So with us, and so when such light falls on us for many years. It's a beautiful poem. And again, I what I love about this is the rhythms of it really come true. You talked about the importance of form earlier, really come true when you read the thing aloud. There's a music to it that kind of drives a lot of the the kind of the more revelatory disclosures in the poem, the wisdom of the poem. Is wisdom born not just by understanding, but by rhythm, which I think is really interesting. I love its understated form. So you have three unrhymed, but rhythmically musical quatrains. So there's 12 lines in it. Mm-hmm. And the first sentence of the poem only concludes at the beginning of the third stanza, right? Uh-huh. With the phrase, "You will understand." Mm-hmm. It's a poem to me about the acquisition of wisdom, but it's a particular kind of wisdom. It's the wisdom of light, right? Yeah. This photosynthesis, a kind of divine wisdom that distills on us slowly, as in photosynthesis for a plant. Now, is my reading of that generally true, or am I way off base?
No, it's perfect. Plants eat light. I'm so fascinated by that. And when you really understand that, you begin to view every choice that a plant makes, and they do make choices. There's a quality called phototropism, that they move toward the light, and you see that their entire life revolves around what I expect is a blend of hunger and joy. They delight in that. They want to be in the light. And in this poem, it's a movement from green to green. It's a movement from the hard surface level patina of verdigris, right? Which is what happens to, you know, brass or bronze. It's a green that comes upon metal. But it ends with a green that is alive and that moves and that spins and that eats and has an inner life to it. And so this is a meditation on being with someone you love and understanding that that presence over time is light, and choosing to bask in that light. The image is a deeper than superficial acceptance of that light, which feeds you. And I do think that that's an acquisition of wisdom, or an acquisition at least of a particular kind of understanding or knowing.
Yeah, which I think is beautiful. It's great. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't happen instantaneously, right? That consumption of light, right? It's the kind of thing that actually bears its own fruit, or kind of grows the plant, you know, sort of over time. Small plant grows into a larger plant through that very kind of process. And it's which I love about it. Hence the, you know, kind of learning, you know, through the veritude of glances, every shared hour of daily hands that lay vast truths upon the hollows of your back. It's great, right? It's that those things aren't impressed on us instantaneously. They're so small and subtle. It takes an accumulation of a mass of them to really recognize that it's not happened all at once. It's happened over time, which I think is fantastic. These billion mouths, right? Even in us, that sense these things. You know, one of your gifts as a poet, I think, is a feeling for the aphoristic phrase, like this nugget of wisdom, and that may be distilling thing down that's exactly right to our experience, or could be upending our experience, kind of by upending conventional perception. And given that gift, if it's okay, you may say, "No, Matt, I've got no such gift." But I think you do, actually. I think it's pronounced enough. I think it's easily detected in your work. Yeah. Given that gift, is there a relationship, as you see, between a gift of vision for seeing things in new ways, a gift of expression for speaking them, a gift of rhythm for like syncopating them, and the gift of wisdom? Like, are these gifts related gifts, or is wisdom, the kind of wisdom which you write in this poem, for example, something quite different from vision, expression, rhythm, etc.?
That's a good question. I do think it all has to do with seeing. One of my personal spiritual curiosities, and I'm certainly not alone in this, but is the massive, beautiful overlaps between my Christian faith and the wisdom tradition of Taoism, which is basically a way of looking at nature, at the way of nature, as a balanced system that people are in and learn from. The way that, you know, dark and light balance, the way that hard and soft balance, the way that water will always go down and fire will always go up, and air will always move in circles above the earth, and then the soil also cycles under our feet. Like, these elemental truths are patterns that when we see them, they teach us something, and they're just interesting. Like, they're just interesting. I want to sit and I want to watch the ocean and just like stare at it. And I feel like as I move through my own life, you begin to also see patterns. And the understanding of those patterns accurately, I think, is the acquisition of wisdom. To see, you know, the Tao just means the way. And I like that because the way is one of the earliest names for the Christian faith. And to think about all of this as the way it is, a way of abundance and of joy and of peace and of love, is great. But, you know, the words of Christ are daunting. You have eyes, but you do not see. You have ears, but you do not hear. You could be in the middle of these wonders and be like a kid playing like Candy Crush in the middle of the Met, like not ever looking up. Or maybe it registers visually on, like, you know, your retina, but it doesn't penetrate to the core of you. It's only superficial. And you see this throughout all of wisdom literature. You see it in the book of Proverbs, you see it in the epistles of Paul, like it's everywhere, everywhere. Wake up, be alive, make a choice, like do the thing, open your eyes. So I think what poetry is for me is a way of doing that, frankly. Byung-Chul Han writes, today the human heart is incapable of offering refuge to the imperishable. It says we can't do that. We lack a capacity. Well, poetry helps me give refuge to the imperishable. And I think naming that as good is a choice of wisdom. It's wise of me to say, rather than an acquisition of wealth, I wish to really see myself honestly. And I wish to invest in that seeing and to share that seeing. Rather than an acquisition of honor, I wish to gain understanding. Rather than an acquisition of social power, I wish to know the one whose life is being spoken all around me, in the soil and the stones and in the words of, and faces of other people. Poetry helps with that. And yes, that is wisdom.
That's great.
That is the way of wisdom. And it's the invitation to which I would like to spend my whole life accepting and just telling everybody, like, do that thing. Go do that thing.
Yeah, I love that. You've got good precedent there for that wish in Solomon, obviously. and I think there's so much you said there that's so great, Paul. And something in there about the recognition of these patterns. And these patterns, once we begin to sort of discern the form of these patterns take, that's wisdom. I'm thinking about, like, you know, Paul, the other Paul, in 1 Corinthians, when talking about the gifts of the Spirit, the gift of wisdom. And to think about wisdom in relation to pattern recognition, I think is really fascinating. It's a great insight. Is there a poem in the collection to which you'd turn us?
Yeah, why don't we read, it's a sonnet on page 53 of the collection. This is called For V the Bag Lady, Great in the Kingdom of Heaven. And it's an absolutely true story. You'd have to smell the potluck food she brought. It likely turned. The lukewarm food bank cheese or last month's beef gleaned from behind the store would knock you back. Nobody said a word. She moved in floral muumuus like a queen. She had no teeth. She'd squeak in from the rain to shed her mildewed layers by her pew and make hot chocolate in cheap styrofoam. Years later, I was hard up out at school. Two jobs, bill due, and $8 in the bank. Somehow she heard. Her father had just died. Left her $10,000, and she gave half to me. I still can see her lift her hands to sing. In them, I watched her lifting everything.
It's a great poem. You say this is based on a true set of events?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. No kidding.
Okay. Well, that's a remarkable story, and it's a great poem. And can I ask you about then the coordination of story and poem? Because I love in here, right? You have again the kind of a soft volta when you kind of go to years later. So you have the scene of, you know, bag lady brought food that was clearly turned, you know, and wasn't going to be the first. In the buffet line, people did not go to that first. Let's put it that way, right?
Let's put it that
way. And but yet she's there and she's contributing and her presence there is meaningful in itself. Okay. Yeah. Years later.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a passage of many years of time from one line to the next, and then this remarkable gift that she gives, you know, it's the classic widow, the widow of two mites, all right, you know, in a way. Yeah. How does that kind of experience become a sonnet and not like an epic poem about your experience of hard times?
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure, honestly. I think that's how it came out. I think that the natural form of the sonnet is, you know, you set something up, you develop it, you turn it, and then you conclude it. And that's a very powerful and simple storytelling rhythm. And an event like this, which might be read as, I had an expectation of that this woman's gifts were not something to be desired, right? And then to be the recipient of a profound generosity because she saw me in a time of great need and gave massively sacrificially to simply bless me. Like, that is an incredible story. It's a true story. And I think the form of the sonnet just sort of made sense. There was structure to it. There was pattern to it. It was one of those moments in life that comes full circle, like, you know. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does.
All,
it's great. I actually love the story being told in the sonnet form. And what I love about the way the sonnet compresses the story is that it focalizes it around the woman and not around necessarily your difficulty. You see her in early on in the poem, and you know, her munificence is a beggarly munificence. This is not someone who has much, but she's giving what she has.
Yeah.
Later, when she comes across much, certainly a great deal much by comparison to what she'd had, she still gives that away. And I love the attention that it pays to this woman who, in two different circumstances, is in many ways the same person, has the same impulses
completely
toward benevolence, right?
She gave everything she had, and that gave a dignity and a lifting effect to everything around her.
Yeah.
But you can't see that until you can see it. It's one of those things that you're like, you can walk right past that and not see that the kingdom of, like, that such as this is great in the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah.
This person who would be dismissed so quickly. And yet, wow,
what a
moment to receive generosity from someone.
Oh, yeah.
Someone like that.
No, it's an amazing story, Paul. It's an amazing story. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing human being that you had the blessing to know. Cassie, I'm going to do this fairly quickly here. There are two poems in here that are kind of side by side, face by face on the page, on pages 42 and 43, The Dream and Crosses. And I'm going to, these poems, they're short and they're kind of rhythmic. They're very kind of strictly formal in ways that are deceptively simple, but simplicity creates, I think, a set of disclosures that I think are profound. And I want to ask you about the relationship between the form and the disclosure, between the simple and the profound, really. So here's the first one. It's called The Dream, and it reads, I woke and all the kingless world was bleak. I slept and earth was governed by the meek. I woke and there was roaring from the south. I slept and children stopped the lion's mouth. I woke and saw the locust eat the wheat. I slept and wept before the mercy seat. I know I sojourn in the land of Seem, but which is real, my God, and which the dream?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And here's the poem Crosses, right set alongside it. And again, that poem, The Dream, four little couplet stanzas, right? I woke, I slept, I woke, I slept, I woke, I slept, and then reflection in the last of the couplets. Here's Crosses. This is now four short quatrains, again, three short four-line stanzas. And here this poem is Crosses. The carpenters was made of wood. The mother's was her son. So it is with everyone, with everyone. What we hold dear is laid on us, then we are laid on it, and down us run the blood and spit, the blood and spit. The lover's cross is made of love. Someone's is made of me. God's cross is made of all we see, of all we see. All right. The where you get in here, the question about waking and sleeping in the first poem, like, are we sure that things that we see, the things at which we focus and fixate, the things that derive our attention, are those the real things? Or are those just the kind of the Platonic cave illusion? And, and then in the second one, right, that notion about crosses not just being, I mean, certainly there's one unique, famous, you know, instance of a crucifixion that changed the entire universe, changed the world. But then there are other kind of metaphorical crosses that are much more pervasive across our own experience, and that God's cross is a function of the full measure of all of human and beyond experience. How I'm one again, the structures are so tight, and they're composed of these antitheses, you know, and these connections that you draw. How much was the vision there a product of the form in which you put the poems, that the form driving these kinds of correlative insights and juxtapositions?
It's a good question. You know, both of these poems were written orally. They were written in my mind. I didn't begin by sitting down with a piece of paper or in front of a keyboard, but I wrote both of them actually while walking. I remember that very specifically. And so at the time, and even still, I'm very fascinated by the capacity and the rhythm of what we might think of as a nursery rhyme, but, you know, think of Blake and Dickinson.
Right.
And I have a whole thing about like nursery rhyme and that sort of, you know, the epigram, aphoristic poetry, you know, as a wisdom tradition, and engaging with that very much in line with what we talked about earlier in this conversation. So in this case, the cadences of nursery rhyme were very present to me, and the simplicity and directness that was there was just the most natural way to express these two different but related sentiments that I was feeling. In the case of the dream, that is, you know, what do you do with the fact that sometimes the deeper reality feels like a dream, right? Like mercy or the meek governing the earth. Like that feels like a fantasy. That feels like a dream. Like that only happens when I'm asleep. And then I wake up and I see the way things are. And so the whole point is just, what's real? Like what's actually real? Like what's more real? The thing that I see when I'm waking or the thing that I see in my heart? And that's something that is worth exploration, I think. I'm not going to answer that. We all, like, life means wrestling with that question. I am always going to err on the side of the dream, though. That's just who I am. In the case of crosses, this is highly formal. Three stanzas. The last line of each one has four beats, which is, you know, which is four distal wounds on the cross. It's you being pinned to it, right? With everyone, the blood and spit of all we see. Highly intentional. And the sentiment, again, is just extremely, extremely simple. The thing that you love is what you carry, and it's where you die. That's it. And then the last move, where we actually look out into the world and we see, well, what if all of this is being carried and all of this is being loved? And, you know, that's actually quite related to the dream, right? That question of what's more real. Well, I don't know, but I do choose to believe in faith that God is carrying this as beloved, typified, of course, in the historic cross of Jesus Christ, but metaphorically extended to touch every single thing I see. And into that life I am called, and into that death I am called too. So it's a great question. The form is natural, but these poems were written in their entirety in my head before I wrote them down. And that, I think, is part of why they're as metrical as they are, they're as even as they are. They began as spoken things.
That's great. I love it, Paul. Thank you. Okay, we have time for one more poem here. Is there a poem that you want to turn our attention?
Yeah, let's look at the last poem in the collection. That's The Sower. So much of The Locust Years thematically is about things that grow and things that are not growing, things that are being eaten, things that are dead, things that are disappointing. And The Sower is the conclusion of this. As a quick note, you know, the book is divided into four parts: the springs, the summers, the falls, and the winters. Not a single season, but multiples. And the book sort of goes in circles. You're intended to get to the end and then kind of go back to the beginning and start again. That's how life works. So The Sower is the hinge on which the larger collection is turning in a lot of ways. And I'll just read it. The Sower. I will reject my hope of good result and kindle corn into the sullen sod, push treasure to the narthex of the worm, measure out dark furrows in the yard, as I have done for years before this one, with patient loss of time and clean belief, watching the sprouted seeds each droop and fail, be shredded, pucked on, fiddled down by feet. For hope and folly's boundary lines are thin. Idiots and believers share a bed too short for stretching on. And how I still can do this, I don't know. But I do. And with a love of it, packing earth under my broken nails, and looking for that dear face in the dirt, to send up shoots, to praise the eaten years.
It's great. It's a great poem, Paul. I love that you're in the collection of this poem. I've got a question or two about it, but first of all, you give your thoughts about it. What led to the poem? Why place this one, the very last one?
Yeah, I think that I think it's a poem of surrender, like in the best of ways. Like, I'm giving up, but I'm not giving up. That's what it's about.
Well, and what you said earlier about telling the truth, right? Like, poetry about truth. The very first line: I will reject my hope of good result. So rejection of hope is how the poem begins, which is great, right? Yeah, but clearly there's something in here. Well, I'll get to that question in a second, but yeah, please, I cut you off. Go on.
Not at all. I mean, yes, so it's ironic. I will reject my hope of good result. And then the whole poem is hope, the whole thing. You can't plant without hope. Like, planting a seed is hope. But I'm also releasing my expectation of what's going to happen. And I think that that's the sentiment of this book. That's the sentiment, certainly, of this poem. And it's the sentiment of certain phases of our lives where we just say, look, I can't control it actually at all. Yet I'm going to plant and I'm going to water and I'm going to try. And I'm going to try to do it with as much peace and care and love and grace and faith as I possibly can muster. And that paradox, that irony, I think, is attuning ourselves to some of those larger patterns that we've already talked about. That's how nature works. Nature is so full of reversals, and yet it's always blooming. It's always abundant. And so this is an attempt, I think, to say, hey, I think I start to see what this all actually requires. I need to reject my hope of good result. I need to let go of the outcome. And I need to keep planting and keep working in hope. Yeah,
I love this. Can I ask you about that? Because the first line rejects, at least the speaker, the poet, professes to reject hope. And the beginning of the last stanza, he said, but do I do, and with a love of it, packing earth under my broken nails and looking for that dear face in the dirt to send up shoots. That dear face in the dirt to send, looking for the face to send up shoots. There's hope in there. The lines before it, though, just the love of the thing that you're, there's not hope of good result, but there is a love for the process of planning. Can there be love without hope? Can there be love that's relinquished hope? Or does love, in your understanding, imply a kind of a hope for fruitfulness of some kind?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Eliot here, right? I said to my heart, wait without hope, for hope would be hope of the wrong thing. right?
Yeah.
That's, I think, what this is. There's something about life that teaches us to let go. But the irony is that sometimes when you let go, you're actually grasping something for the first time. And that sounds very, I don't know, sounds like something you'd print on, you know, the back of a tea towel. It just sounds like a sentiment that's just kind of like thin, but it's actually profound. Like, you let go to hang on. You surrender to have victory. Like, this is how it works. And so that deer face in the dirt that you're looking for, like nails broken, digging with your hands, choosing to plant, having tried this, having given up, that speaks to many things. Like, that image, I think each of us can carry to a different specific of our lives, and that's just how it works. But is love tied to hope? Yeah, I think it is. And whether it is or not, like, the experience of loving means looking to be present with another. And that presence itself is all of it. I'll just say it that way.
Yeah.
That presence in one's own life is all of it.
I love that. I really believe that in love, genuine, true, pure love, we draw close to God. And where God is, hope is. And I love that you quoted Eliot there, hope, maybe hope of the wrong thing. Is it not that we can always put our finger on what exactly we're hoping for, just there's something about the presence of that one that we love, or whatever it is we may love, and the presence of God in and through that love, that itself gives us hope, and so, you know, that plants hope in something that's difficult to name. So thank you for that sentiment. In fact, thank you, Paul, for these poems and for this conversation. You are a terrific poet and a wonderful interlocutor about these poems and poems generally, and about the life of the spirit and more broadly. It's a real blessing to me to know you and to talk with you. Thank you so much for your work and your time this morning talking with me.
Oh, it's so mutual. Thank you for a rich conversation and for your attention to my work. It really is meaningful to me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.